Good morning, everyone. My name is Kaku, and I want to express my gratitude for being here today and to say that I find myself being grateful quite frequently nowadays. Pretty much every day. I'm grateful to be in this zendo. I'm grateful when I go to my therapy office and do therapy. I'm grateful when I go up to Morningside Heights and teach at either Union Seminary or New York Theological Seminary. I feel very rich. So I'm especially grateful to be here and share this day with you. I want to say that I have been in love with Dogen since my first weekend retreat that was an introduction to Zen quite some time ago. Basically, my reason for being in love with Dogen is the same reason that Shohaku Okumura gives for why he wrote the Ginjo Koan. He says something like this. He started to study with Uchiyama Roshi in Japan when he was a teenager. And if you studied with Uchiyama, you were going to be reading a lot of Dogen or hearing a lot from Dogen. And so his interest was piqued just by hearing Uchiyama talk about Dogen and reading Dogen's Shobogenzo and other writings by Dogen. So he went looking for something more to learn about Dogen. And in the entire high school that he was in, there was only one book that he found about Dogen. And it had a brief biography and the author's commentaries on Shobogenzo, Bindoa, Ginjo Koan, and Shoji. Bindoa is the talk on the wholehearted practice of the way. Ginjo Koan also is translated as actualization of reality. And Shoji is about life and death. Those of you that have become members here have all become familiar with the introduction that is given when you come in to celebrate your decision to become a part of the Sangha. And the introduction goes something like, we come here because we are mostly concerned about the issues of life and death. And we ask your help to join us in our search for understanding. So Shohaku says that it was the beauty of Dogen Zenji's writing that most impressed him, especially in the Ginjo Koan. He says, it seemed like a poem to me, and I copied the entire text in my notebook. The beginning of Ginjo Koan, in which Dogen Zenji discusses Buddha Dharma, the Buddha way, realization and delusion, practice and enlightenment, and life and death, were incomprehensible to me. Yet, like many teenagers, I considered myself a poet. He says, although I quit writing poems when I began practicing Zen. Go figure. Some of us just start writing poems. Anyway, he says, I appreciated the poetic beauty of the second half of the text, especially Dogen's images of a bird flying in the sky and a fish swimming in the ocean. One of the few sentences I did understand, he says, that affected me deeply read, therefore, if there are fish that would swim or birds that would fly only after investigating the entire ocean or sky, they would find neither path nor place. Back to that in a moment. I'm taken, I think I was taken by Dogen for a reason that's very, very hard to nail down. It's about language and it's about speech and how amazing they are. I first heard Dogen in his words on the Ginjo Koan. I had no idea what the words meant, but something touched me deeply. And I immediately knew that this was someone I wanted to hear more from and read more of. I remember, for example, hearing Moses Hadas reciting Plato in Greek. I did not know Greek whatsoever. I mean, you know, enough to get into a fraternity or something, but that doesn't tell you much about Plato. So, but it was just, you know, hearing the words and the man's voice. And then I remember Abraham Heschel reading from the 55th chapter of Isaiah. And I didn't know Hebrew from even Greek, but it was profoundly moving just to hear these words spoken. So I feel the same way about Dogen, even if it's read in English. In fact, it helps if it's in English. But, you know, that's something, one of the marvels about speech and about the human heart. How do we, it's like we get it without understanding it. And that's exactly how we should read Dogen. We should hear it and take it in like you listen to music, like you listen to poetry being read, perhaps like you read poetry, without an analytic eye, you know, making your brain understand things first, but let your heart be open to it. You know, we used to say before a Dharma talk, the Dharma is dark to the mind and radiant to the heart. Well, I like that. That's pretty good. The head doesn't really know what in the world is going on, but the heart knows. So I have been in love with Dogen, hearing him without understanding him, basically whatsoever. So I want to delve into the Ginjo Koan briefly, somewhat, a little bit, so that hopefully some of the flavor of the Ginjo Koan will impart itself. So it begins, when all dharmas are the Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice, life and death, Buddhas and living beings. When the 10,000 dharmas are without fixed self, there is no delusion and no realization, no Buddhas and no living beings, no birth and no death. Since the Buddha way by nature goes beyond the dichotomy of abundance and deficiency, there is arising and perishing, delusion and realization, living beings and Buddhas. Therefore, flowers fall even though we love them. Weeds grow even though we dislike them. Conveying oneself toward all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. All things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. Those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded in realization are living beings. Furthermore, there are those who attain realization beyond realization and those who are deluded within delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they don't need to perceive they are Buddhas. However, they are enlightened Buddhas and they continue actualizing Buddha. In seeing color and hearing sound with body and mind, although we perceive them intimately, the perception is not like reflections in a mirror or the moon in water. When one side is illuminated, the other is dark. To study the Buddha way, is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. To be verified by all things is to let the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop off. There's a trace of realization that cannot be grasped. We endlessly express this ungraspable trace of realization. When a fish swims, no matter how far it swims, it doesn't reach the end of the water. When a bird flies, no matter how high it flies, it cannot reach the end of the sky. When the bird's need or the fish's need is great, the range is large. When the need is small, the range is small. In this way, each fish and each bird uses the whole of space and vigorously acts in every place. However, if a bird departs from the sky or a fish leaves the water, it immediately dies. We should know that for a fish, water is life. For a bird, sky is life. A bird is life. A fish is life. Life is a bird. Life is a fish. And we should go beyond this. There is practice and enlightenment. That is the way of living beings. Therefore, if there are fish that would swim or birds that would fly only after investigating the entire ocean or sky, they would find neither path nor place. When we make this very place our own, our practice becomes the actualization of reality. The master said, Master Baosh of Mount Magu was waving a fan. A monk approached him and asked, "The nature of wind is ever present and permeates everywhere. Why are you waving a fan?" The master said, "You know only that the wind's nature is ever present. You don't know that it permeates everywhere." The monk said, "How does the wind permeate everywhere?" The master just continued waving the fan. The monk bowed deeply. The genuine experience of Buddha Dharma and the vital path that has been correctly transmitted are like this. To say we should not wave a fan because the nature of wind is ever present, and that we should feel the wind even when we don't wave a fan, is to know neither ever presence nor the wind's nature. Since the wind's nature is ever present, the wind of the Buddha's family enables us to realize the gold of the great earth and to transform the water of the long river into cream. We come to Zen practice because we are concerned about the matter of life and death. How does the Ginjo Koan help us to understand the issues of life and death? Particularly, how does it help us understand ourselves and our lives? I'm going to read some sections from Shohaku's book that will help us get into this matter. He begins by talking about Chinese characters, or rather what's called in the Japanese system kanji. Ginjo Koan is written in kanji. He says, "Gin," the gin of Ginjo, means to appear or to show up, to come out or to appear. Well, those of us that are gay really appreciate this, to come out and to appear. Yes. So we get that so much, that so far. So gin can be a kind of manifestation or actualization of something potential into something actual. And the jo in Japanese means to become, to complete, or to accomplish. As a verb, the compound term ginjo means to manifest or actualize, to appear and become. As a noun, it refers to reality as it actually is happening in the present moment. The meaning of koan, however, is more difficult to explain. Koan carries the connotation of both a truth and a question. Koan is commonly understood as referring to a public document placed on the desk of a government office or a law issued by the emperor. It's an expression of unchangeable truth or reality. The ko of the word koan means to be public, which means to equalize inequality. This equalizing is a reference to the duties of government officials in ancient China. To make something public, therefore, is to make something equal. So ko, in this broader sense, means to equalize the unfair or the unequal situations among beings that arise in this world of disorder and discrimination. The ko in Dogen's text has a particular use for the second part of the word, the an, and it refers to a place to think, read, and write, a word for a paper or document placed on a desk. It also is used to refer to a massage for healing. I lost that. So think of that every time you hear a koan. Just think massage for healing. To investigate in order to fix something that is out of order. So that's what we're doing on the cushion. We're working on our koan, trying to investigate it in order to fix something that is out of order. So the ko means, according to Dogen's disciple, Sinan, which I assume means ijo. Right? Ko means to be public, to equalize inequality, as I mentioned, and it means to keep one's lot. The an, keeping one's lot, means recognizing one's place in society. It also refers to the individuality of people. It means recognizing that we all have our own particular personality traits and capabilities that make us unique. When we read the word koan in this way, we see that it refers both to the equality of all things and to the uniqueness or particularity of each and every being. Koan refers to the Shobogenzo itself. Shobogenzo means true Dharma eye treasury. So Shobogenzo is a name for the true reality of all beings. So according to Gosho, the word koan expresses the reality of our own lives. We are at the intersection of equality, meaning the universality and the unity and oneness of all beings, and the inequality or the difference and uniqueness, the particularity and individuality of our particular self. Reality or emptiness includes both unity and difference. So this is all right here in the first word of koan. And as we get into the meaning of Shobogenzo as the true Dharma eye treasury. Shohaku says, I often use the example of a hand in speaking about emptiness. We call it a hand, or we can call it a collection of five fingers. As a collection of five fingers, each finger is independent and has a different shape and function. We cannot exchange the little finger with the thumb because each has its own function, shape, and unique way of being. A thumb cannot do precisely what a little finger does, and a little finger cannot do what a thumb does. Each finger is truly independent, and yet, from another perspective, as one hand, all five fingers function together, and there is no separation between them. When we see the fingers in this united way, there is really just one hand. Each one of us can be viewed in the same way. We are both universal and individual. This universality and individuality are not two separate aspects of our being. Each is absolute. One hand is 100% one hand. Five fingers are 100% five fingers. That's the nature of our human existence. These beings cannot be the same because each has its own particular time, position, and causal history. This whole world, this whole universe, and all of time from beginningless beginning to endless end are one. We cannot separate ourselves or anything else from this unity. So we may view reality as a collection of independent things, or we may view it as one vast, seamless whole. This is what we mean when we say form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Individuality, uniqueness, and commonness, oneness. That's what we say each time we recite the Heart Sutra. So we are all interconnected completely, and we are all whole, all living the same life. In this way, the whole universe is just one thing, as five fingers are just one hand. And yet, eyes are eyes, a nose is a nose, a tongue is a tongue, and this person, Kaku, is just Kaku. I'm not you, and you are not me. Viewed from one side, everything is different, and viewed from another side, everything is the same. To see reality from both sides is the basic viewpoint of Mahayana Buddhism, including Zen. So how does this help us with our own lives? I had planned to go to Auschwitz with Zen Peacemaker Order for several years. And this past summer, I was bound and determined to make that happen. And then a couple of months before I was to go, I was told that I had pancreatic cancer. And so the question was, would I go or not? And I never doubted that I would go. I meant to go. And so I did. And the experience was very powerful. I think it probably will stay with me, and you know, I'll be digesting it the rest of my life. When I first heard my diagnosis, my first thought was, oh, as I go to Auschwitz, I am not separate from them. I too will die. Now, for most of us, this is not new information. You know, we know that as a, you know, intellectual truth. But it's different knowing it intellectually and finding something is in you that might actually destroy you. You have a disease, or you have a sickness, or an illness, or you might have, you know, fallen off a cliff or the roof of a house or something. There are all kinds of things that threaten us with the end of our lives. Most of the time, we don't think about it. But we are dedicated to looking at the matters of life and death. So the important experience that I had by this realization that I too will die as I was going to Auschwitz was the realization that we are linked by this single fact that we all die. The way in which we die and when we die and when we're alive and so forth, we're not much in control of. Although, you know, there are certain things we're supposed to do to last longer, like exercise, eat right, and other things, you know. But facing the reality of death's proximity shifts the center of one's own gravity in a certain way. And so I've discovered that some things have changed for me. I no longer want a BMW. I'm quite satisfied. I got a Subaru, you know, and I'm quite happy with it. This is a huge change for me. You don't know how much of my life I spent wanting a BMW. And sometimes I had them, but another thing is I'm living right now in what used to be a rather affluent part of Huntington, Long Island. At least by my terms, it was an affluent part. What I find is I'm looking around at all these houses, and I'm not experiencing the envy that I used to experience. You know, I used to wish, oh, if only I had that kind of a house, or, you know, if only the living room was configured in this way, or, you know, a bedroom was in that way, and then, oh, window was like just over the perfect scene, you know, then I would be able to write, among other things. That's not on my agenda now. Why is that? Well, the long and short of it is that I don't think I'd get very far in paying off a mortgage at this point in my life. But there's something deeper about this. Some things that used to be important aren't so important anymore. And it's a relief. You know, it's lifting of a certain kind of burden. Some of our desires are burdensome, not to mention distracting. And we're vowed to put an end to them, mind you. That's pretty difficult, I find, to do. But I also used to sort of drive myself a bit frantic or anxious or full of angst and storm and drung because I couldn't find the perfect boyfriend. I'm not looking for a perfect boyfriend now. It helps that I have the perfect dog, but... some things have changed. One thing that has not changed is I started a few years ago, went back to playing the piano and getting lessons, piano lessons again. And I still want a grand piano. And that desire is still there. So, you know, I'm not done yet. So it does something to us when we really realize the fact of our dying, and realize not just the fact of our dying, but our unity with all things. So I was thinking about this. A few years ago, I was a scuba diving instructor, and I used to lead people on trips where we would combine, mind you, group therapy, scuba diving, and Zen. The common denominator, of course, is depth. And I had fun, and I think other people did too. But one of my feelings when I first started scuba diving and you know, got down, you know, 60 feet, 100 feet, more than you're supposed to go, was that this is home. I felt at home in the ocean. In a very, very profound way, I feel like I belong here. I was smart enough, however, not to pull the regulator out of my mouth. I still stayed connected to air. But there was this profound sense of, I belong here. And I think there's something primordial about that. You know, we do come from the sea. Many, many thousands, millions of years ago, I suppose. But for me, the ocean remains there not only as a place that I love and enjoy going to and going into, but it's a metaphor for the whole Megillah, you know, all of life, night, day, cosmos, stars, you know, you, me, us, everywhere, wherever we are, and the idea that we are one the ocean helps me understand that oneness, because I believe it's in our blood, literally, and in our bones. And so investigating this issue of life and death, you know, we search for metaphors or symbols of what life and death are and what happens after we die and all of that stuff. And Buddhism teaches us the impermanence of all things, so everything is always changing. You and I change constantly. Who we are even changes. But in my mind, when I die, I have already asked that my ashes and whatever is left be taken into the ocean. To me, it'd be a homecoming. And there's something like that that I find about that that I find gratifying. The big point that is kind of more subtle is that who we are as human beings is who we are having come from that. So it's not just, you know, oh, I want to have my ashes thrown into the ocean. It's like we came from that. And so we're still we carry in the salt and in the water of our bodies the connection to all living things. And I like that. And that's why we say there's no birth and there's no death. There's form and there's emptiness. We call this body a form, but it's also filled with emptiness, changing all the time. To see ourselves as having, I mean, I people ask me, you know, what do you think about life after death? And, you know, as a pastor, I get that question quite a bit, and I'm supposed to give a certain answer. I don't like that certain answer, actually. It's all metaphor. And so whether we talk about heaven or hell or, you know, anything like that, it's basically about the state of mind that we're in. And so for me, I do not expect to have an existence or to be recognizable in any way, shape, or form as Kaku or Robert Gunn after I die. I do not look forward to a heaven just because I don't think that's the way it is. But I do think that as our bodies decay, we return to where we came from. And we do have this idea that life goes on. And that's kind of a guess, or, you know, it's something we comfort ourselves with, I think. Who knows? But my point is that I find in just these opening sentences from the Ginjo Koan enough to base a life on, and enough pointers to really dig into and to experience some of the truth of our own impermanence and our own reality. And most of all, the realization that we are not separate from other people. This is an age that direly needs to understand what we have to say, that we are all one, whatever the color of our skin. And when we're not taking care of each other, we're not taking care of the body, the whole body. So we have to take care of others in order to take care of ourselves. And there's a great comfort in realizing the incredible multiplicity of life, and the many, many, many different ways that we express our livingness, our vitality, and our aliveness. And it's all wonderful, idiosyncratic, and joyful from my point of view. So thank you for sharing the time and this space as we consider who we are.